What you're about to hear is an interview with Hans von Sponeck on October 7th in Copenhagen, Denmark. Von Sponeck was in Copenhagen hoping to persuade the EU to choose a path that embraces international law and humanitarian concern. Von Sponeck was UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq before resigning in protest of the harmful result of sanctions. There's been a lot of debate on whether the US and the UK or with a UN coalition should attack Iraq, but there have already been an increasing number of airstrikes this year, including a civilian airport in Basra. In what ways has an attack already begun in Iraq?
Well, this is a silent war that has been going on, particularly since December of 1998. Operation Desert Fox was the most obvious manifestation of that intention to destabilize and to attack. But since then, US and UK pilots operate under what has become known as enlarged rules of engagement that allow them to be much more liberal in attacking Iraqi installations, often victimizing civilian facilities also. In 1999, when I in Baghdad issued my first airstrike report, I reported that in the course of the year there had been 132 airstrikes, one every 3 days on average, with 144 casualties and over 400 wounded and a lot of civilian property destroyed. So this is nothing new. This is a silent war, unreported, and when referred to, often it is indicated that it is an attack prompted by Iraqis, so it's in self-defense. But the main justification for having these zones is allegedly Resolution 688, the protection of minorities, an appeal to the Secretary General to look after minorities. But in fact, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the establishment of no-fly zones in which two air forces can operate. It's a violation of international law.
What can be done by European countries and others in the international community if the U.S., with or without the U.K., attacks Iraq without a U.N. Security Council mandate?
What can we do if the country that is the outstanding military power decides to attack? What is left to us is to protest, to serve notice to the U.S. government that European governments do not accept this, that they consider this a violation, and appeal to America not to continue, or better, not to start an attack against the country for which there's absolutely no evidence of an imminence of threat coming from Iraq that would justify a preemptive strike.
But what more could be done in terms of the U.S.? Very much is very likely would go ahead with this kind of action without a multilateral support. What could the international community do in terms of reacting to this consistent U.S. Move to act unilaterally?
As I say, before it happens, only to discourage. I think this is a test of a friendship. If Europe is a friend of the U.S., then this is the moment of truth. That's the moment when one has to say what you're planning to do has no basis, no moral, no ethical, and no legal basis, so don't do it. If the U.S. decides to ignore all this and go ahead and strike, what can the European or international community do other than condemn it and then try and be helpful in accommodating refugees? There will be plenty. In helping to provide medical care for the many wounded and casualties that will arise, and to be available in the post-war national reconstruction period that will be so vital to reestablish Iraq as a nation. More we cannot do.
With regard to inspectors, do you think there's any truth to the theory that the White House is putting conditions on the Iraqis that they know Iraq cannot accept to force the situation to come to an attack?
Yeah, I would say the government has decided on regime change. Anything that now is offered, for example, the unconditional return of inspectors, is, of course, blocking this intention for regime change to go ahead with it. Also, unexpectedly, the resistance from the international community to this concept of regime change has forced the U.S. to go multilateral rather than unilateral initially. But the intentions in Washington are to do this in order to give the impression that they do whatever they decide to do with the full support of the international community. There may be surprises because the Security Council may not be willing to go along with that. And then we'll see, will they abide by international law, by the decision of a council, or will they decide to go it alone, if you want. But I think the intention has always been to go ahead with regime change, and therefore they will now try by every means possible to make the return of arms inspectors next to impossible, to build into the conditions so much that would create many occasions for a pretext to say Iraq is not cooperating and therefore should be attacked, and then go ahead and attack it. So this is a very unfortunate constellation that has been arisen. One can only hope that the Security Council will make sure that the member on the council, the most powerful member, is finally realizing that this road that they have chosen cannot lead to a situation where the Middle East is getting back into the equilibrium that everyone in the international community, other than the U.S. at the moment, hopes it will.
Building on that, can you talk about the dangers of any future inspections regime being compromised by espionage or information gathering, as UNSCOM was?
Iraq knows very well that this is the last chance to avoid a military confrontation. So from the Iraqi side, we can assume that they will do everything possible to avoid a confrontation, to cooperate. It is now on the Secretary General to ensure that the team that goes there is of the highest level of integrity, that they are not only professionals in their field, but they also are in no way linked to intelligence organizations in the countries from which they come. Dr. Hans Blix has the incredibly difficult task to monitor the behavior of his team. I think it will be the responsibility of him and the Secretary General to report to the Security Council any case where arms inspectors are either offering themselves or are being misused by intelligence organs outside the United Nations for the purpose of conducting spying activities. So it's a very tough assignment, which one can only hope will be successful as far as Dr. Hans Blix and Secretary General Kofi Annan are concerned.
If you could talk about international law, how it's broken perhaps by the Iraqis, but also some of the ways that you've observed in your experience that international law is being broken by US or UK with regards to the time period that's gone on since the Gulf War, and also maybe who the main perpetrators of the suffering of the Iraqi people would be in your observation.
There's no question that Iraq has violated many norms of civilized behavior, has broken human rights law within their own borders. But as I've said many times, this surely is not a justification for doing the same on the international side. And international law, as we have it, as we have created it since the end of the Second World War, I think there's hardly any such law that was meant to protect people that hasn't been broken as a result of 12 years of sanctions. Whether it's the Convention on the Rights of the Child, whether it's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there's an article in that declaration, Article 26, which guarantees every individual, every human being, the right for the full development of the human personality. Which Iraqi youth, child, has that opportunity to develop his or her personality under the conditions which are forced upon them under sanctions? Impossible. Mortality rates in Iraq today, as compared to 1990, are the highest of the 188 countries that UNICEF has surveyed in the year 2000. That's a violation of, if you want, of the Genocide Convention. It's genocide. If you knowingly don't stop death as a result of a policy that you have introduced, then you are culpable. Then you are criminally responsible for mortality. And this is what has happened in Iraq, whether we like it or not, as a result of a sanction regime that hasn't understood that after so many years it has crossed the red line from what could be explained and accepted as collateral damage, and has today become a clear violation of international law, because if you do something knowingly that is a violation and you continue to do that, then the issue of intent comes into it. And if you purposely do that, then you are displaying intent, and then you become culpable, as I said. And this is demonstrable for the conventions on the right of the child, on the Genocide Convention, but also on the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. It is also demonstrable in terms of the Hague Convention, which indicates that food and medicine should be allowed into a country regardless of the details of sanctions. But what we see are continuous blocking of humanitarian supplies, including medicine and medical equipment, by the government of the US and by Britain. Now, this is a violation of an international agreement. So there is no shortage of evidence that what we see today is indeed a frightful, a tragic violation of the very bodies of international law that have been created, often under the leadership of the very countries that today are violating them.
I'm Patrick Beckett in Copenhagen.